Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, probably one of the most intelligent individuals we've ever had commenting or involved with American politics, Daniel Ellsberg. He was kind of a genius sort, and Harvard actually was a student, or not a student, but Henry Kissinger, what have you, worked in the Pentagon, as of course famous internationally as the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers, gave it first to the New York Times and then the Washington Post, and exposed the inherent deceit of that war. And he wrote 5 years ago, because when he was in the Pentagon, nuclear war planning was on his desk. And he wrote a book that deserved more attention than it got. It's called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And it really is a reminder of something we've tended to forget, the possibility of destroying all life on this planet in a very short amount of time with the use of nuclear weapons, the prevalence of nuclear weapons around. And we are now in a situation where there's, in effect, a horrible war developing over the Ukraine as a kind of surrogate outpost of the United States and Western Europe, and advanced weapons are now being put in. The Russians are obviously invaded. They're involved deeply. And there's all this talk about arresting Putin as a war criminal, pushing them into a corner, the humiliation, regime change President Biden is talking about. And we seem to forget, but Putin has occasionally reminded us that Russia has a nuclear arsenal equivalent to that of the United States. And we're back actually in the worst days of what used to be called mutual assured destruction. So I wanted to turn to Daniel Ellsberg, who has written really the most important, still current book on the existence of nuclear weapons, the threat, and the possibility of our ending it all over this over the Ukraine. You want to take it from there, Dan?
Okay, it's a depressing prospect we're discussing, Robert, because we're approaching an armed conflict between the U.S. and Russia for the first time ever since we put troops in Russia to put down the Bolsheviks in 1919 or so. And in all that time, both sides have avoided actually shooting at each other. And for a good reason, which applies right now, we have what we didn't have 50 years ago, two doomsday machines, as I call them, that is, systems that are designed and readied and rehearsed to destroy most life on Earth because they target military targets in cities, and the firestorms in those cities would put up smoke into the stratosphere where it wouldn't rain out around the globe, killing all harvests for years, up to a decade, and starving nearly everyone on Earth within a year or so. Either side carrying out its present alert capabilities, ready to go in minutes if a warning comes that the other side may be attacking. Either side can destroy or will destroy most life on Earth. So it would seem suicidal to launch that under any conditions. And it would be more than suicidal. It would be what you might call omnicidal or near omnicidal, that is, killing nearly everyone. Why then do we buy these weapons, and why would there ever be a possibility of their being used, as there is this year? Well, I said we're approaching direct conflict, but up till now, we have just been carefully supplying weapons to the target of Russia's aggression to the Ukraine. We haven't put troops in. We haven't put air power in directly, U.S. air power. We're just supplying them. If we did come in directly under current circumstances with the Russian forces so greatly depleted from what the USSR used to have with its Warsaw Pact, now dissolved and now essentially on our side, we would have a pretty good chance of winning a conventional war in Ukraine with our air power and our cruise missiles, with or without troops. That would be very dangerous because we can't really afford for the U.S. to win such a war against Putin, because with his perhaps 1,500 tactical nuclear weapons, the temptation for him to reverse that defeat, to avoid that defeat, by using a nuclear weapon or more, a number of them, would be very great. And in the current world, with two doomsday machines poised at each other, each on a launch on warning status in their intercontinental ballistic missiles, that means use them or lose them, that any indication that they might be attacked by the other side in the near future is a very strong incentive, given our doctrine and our training and our readiness, to launch first, to preempt, as they say, and avert that first strike by the other side. Now, actually, looked at realistically in the light of nuclear winter, there is no benefit to going first, rather going second. Either side actually will set enough smoke into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere, which we only learned 1983, but that was 30 years ago. And our plans don't reflect that at all. The truth is, that given that consideration, going first does not have any benefit at all. But to recognize that would stop the sales of new weapons on each side, actually, which is a very profitable process for our military-industrial complex, preparing for a war that would be omnicidal and insane, actually, to begin, is very profitable. And actually, their side, too, is a capitalist system where the profits occur on that side as well, no doubt getting skimmed off at the top various places. So both sides have been buying weapons which, if launched, would end most human life on Earth. And there's not only the profitability in doing that, but it has certain political benefits as well in the short run, as long as they don't get launched. And I have to keep saying, we're in a situation now where it's possible, with the Russians doing as poorly as they are in the conflict, unexpectedly, where Putin in particular might actually try to reverse the effects by launching a nuclear weapon for the first time ever since Nagasaki, and thus causing a precedent for other people to use them, and other people to get them, so as to deter the use against them. And this is a real possibility. People in Congress and elsewhere, in the Pentagon and society commentary, are calling to do what Zelensky has actually requested. And for him, it's very understandable, a desperate mood facing this overwhelming invasion. He's called for us to have a no-fly zone, to put a lid, to put a ceiling over the attacks on him. And we've done that in the past elsewhere, and very natural for him to want it, except that in this case, it would mean armed conflict between two large nuclear weapon states. A situation in which Ukraine would almost certainly be annihilated, and possibly nearly everyone else. So it's So it's very good that Biden has not so far gone to that. But why not? Why is it not that we're? How can we not be doing what Zelensky asked the Joint Chancellor of Congress and many other parliaments to do, which is to get directly involved with our own forces in this war? And the answer is, Putin is using his nuclear weapons, using them very effectively. The way you use a gun when you point it at somebody in a confrontation, if you get your way without pulling the trigger, that's the best use of the gun. And you couldn't do that without having it. Well, Putin, in this case, is making it clear that if we confronted him with defeat, even with conventional weapons in Ukraine, whether via our support to Ukrainians, which he's threatening against, or our direct involvement, which Zelensky has called for, which we haven't yet done, he might use nuclear weapons against us. And with the knowledge on both sides that that risks blowing up the world, not the Earth, not the planet, but human civilization, and thus shields him so far from having us confront his aggression in conventional terms directly. it's working for them at this point. We've used those threats in the past repeatedly in maintaining our sphere of influence around the world, right up to the borders of the old Soviet Union or of China. He hasn't in the past, because in Europe, Russia had an overwhelming conventional superiority, which it no longer has. So for almost since the fall of the USSR, the Russians have gone back to Eisenhower's old New Look doctrine, massive retaliation doctrine, a reliance on nuclear threats to compensate for the shortcomings of their conventional forces. They're doing what we did in the 50s and the 60s. And neither side has been willing to take a no first use policy or declaration, that is, a commitment never to initiate nuclear war. On the contrary, both sides have promised that they will initiate nuclear war if they find it necessary. It really is essential that we don't make Putin believe that it's necessary for him to do that. That puts enormous incentive toward a negotiated solution of some sort, with concessions on both sides. The only way that you could get a negotiated end to this war. Unfortunately, there seems no sign that either side is willing to do that. So the world is hostage to the development of this conflict, which may go on for a long time.
Well, maybe not. Maybe it'll have an abrupt and horrible end. You were a nuclear war planner. You were in the government. I was something of a critic writing about it. And we both know that under Ronald Reagan, with the whole idea of defenses on nuclear weapons, the whole idea more recently of modernization of these forces, there has been a growing view that these are usable weapons. And that in the case, for instance, we've already seen delivery systems used by Putin for conventional, cruise missiles that could have a nuclear warhead. We know modernization is supposed to give you that capacity. And after all, the United States is the one nation that has used nuclear weapons in wartime, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it seems to me there's a giddiness right now of, you can push this guy and push this guy, and somehow those weapons will not come into play. And I suspect there is, just as there was on the U.S. side in the Cold War and there was on the Soviet side, there's a side there in Moscow that says, look, we built these weapons, and there are some that can be used tactically. And if that's all we've got, and they're talking about that we're war criminals and we're going to be tried, and this is the end of it, you could see people arguing for that. And the other thing we haven't talked about is the first strike capacity. How good are the Russians now at figuring out whether there's been a submarine launch from the United States or some kind of preemptive first strike? And then, of course, the illusion about defense against it, and that you could even win such a war. And there's almost no discussion of that now. There's a giddiness, let's push Putin up against it. And there seems to be an inappropriate feeling of sort of confidence that the nuclear weapons will not be used.
Bob, I hear a lot of people talking that way and preparing that way and spending that way. Does that mean they actually believe it? Not necessarily, because the threats are potentially useful diplomatically if they work, if the other people back off. And the buying the material for them is very profitable all the time. So you don't have to believe what you're saying. As a matter of fact, I would say our forces have been built up almost from the beginning on the basis of a hoax. Let me not go back right to the beginning, but to the period since the mid-60s, 10 years into the nuclear era, 20 years into the nuclear era, when we were confronting another heavily armed nuclear weapons state, the Soviet Union. They didn't really come anywhere near matching us in that until the mid-60s. But that's a long time ago. And during that period, carrying out any of our threats against Russia or another nuclear weapon state, even North Korea, with a tiny fraction of what the Russians have, would be insane. And most people understand that. As you say, there are a few people now, and that's new for the last generation or so, who really do think of using small tactical nuclear weapons, not only buying them, which Trump was for and which Biden is continuing. And as I say, that's good for Northrop Grumman. Just threaten them. They're for threatening, and they're for making profits. But there are people, Elbridge Colby, who worked under Trump, and Brad Roberts, who worked under Trump, and others can be found, high officials, who do talk about using small tactical nuclear weapons to achieve our ends, using them in battle, not only threatening them. That's a threat of an insane action. And if they really believe that can be limited, they're exhibiting a kind of institutional madness that does occur. But I would say what the new ICBMs we're buying, and now I've been trying to avert that for years now, to eliminate ICBMs, I see no chance of doing that now in this new Cold War mood. There wasn't really much chance even a year ago because of the profits and the jobs and the campaign donations and the executive in and out of the Pentagon. So Northrop Grumman was likely to get that contract as it is. Likely. Now it's almost certain. And what does that mean? Those ICBMs, if they went second, well, first, not many of them would go second because they're very vulnerable. They can be attacked and will be attacked in a major nuclear war, unlike our submarine missiles, which can't be targeted and can't be attacked. So these things are in a use them or lose them mode. And if there's any warning that the other side is about to attack, they will be used. To what effect? As I say, it won't make any difference. Their own use will be suicidal, near-omnicidal in the world. There has been a hoax, which has been a very profitable hoax for the last half century and more, that bad as it may be to go first, as our ICBMs are built to do, it's less bad than going second, where we lose them. And that's very plausible to people. It happens to be a total hoax, a delusion. And as I say, very profitable one. Can countries really buy trillions of dollars worth of weapons on the basis of a hoax? Well, look, how many Americans right now, how many Republicans, official people running for office, that's nearly all of them, assert that they believe that Trump won the election last time? Total hoax. In Russia, how much of the Russian public believes what they're getting from the state media, which is almost all there is now, that there is no war? They can't mention the word war. There's a special operation going in there to prevent genocide in the Donbas, which wasn't happening. There was conflict going on. To call it genocide is as crazy as, by the way, for Biden to use the word genocide with respect to Ukraine yet. The Russians haven't come close to doing yet in Ukraine what they did in Afghanistan for 10 years, where 1 million people, perhaps 1.5 million, were killed. That may still happen, but we're not there yet. What we did to Iraq or Afghanistan involved millions of deaths, and we're not there yet. And to call even that genocidal was wrong. It was a war crime. These were all crimes against the peace. These were all huge massacres. But again, to call them genocide, and thus meaning anything goes when it comes to avoiding it. There's no limits. You've got to stop this. We can't make any concessions of any kind, like control over the Donbas, to a side that's genocidal. All of this portends a very long war unless it blows up, which would be even worse, unless it goes nuclear. But if it doesn't go nuclear, we've been preparing since 2015. I won't go into the chronology on that, why that is, but since Russia took the Crimea, actually, and put Russian troops into eastern Ukraine in the Donbas, ever since then, we've been training Ukrainians in this country and elsewhere and in Ukraine for a prolonged guerrilla war, the kind the Soviets had for 10 years in Afghanistan with our encouragement by funding the insurgents, the Islamic right, the Mujahideen. We gave the Russians, as Brzezinski put it, as our national security system put it, we gave the Russians their Vietnam. I think the intent right now is to give, that was the Soviets, to give the Russians another Afghanistan, to bleed them, to make them, as we say very openly, weaker, more isolated in the world at the cost of Ukrainian lives. In other words, kill Russians indefinitely to the last Ukrainian, because what that means in terms of historical insurgencies is for every Russian who gets bled, who gets killed, there are 5 to 10 Ukrainians who are killed in retaliation. So this is a this prospect of doing this instead of negotiating, instead of trying to negotiate, which we're not doing, as far as we can see, seriously, means, you know, is a vicious policy with respect to Ukraine.
Admittedly, but what I'm here to discuss, Daniel, is something that you were once involved in planning to inflict on the world, which is possibility.
Let me correct that a little bit, Bob. What I was involved in was trying to deter and avert what seemed to me and my colleagues at that time the only real way that a nuclear war would occur, and that was with a Soviet surprise attack. Now, that was based on a total mythology, a hoax. It didn't occur. And I was planning, in other words, for the possibility of retaliating. I was always against, as you may or may not know, but inside the system, I was always not just a critic, but, you know, totally opposed to the idea of initiating nuclear war. There were others who did believe in that. I was not one of them. So let's be clear. There are different kinds of planning here. And the kinds I was doing was, in fact, totally unnecessary at that point. The Russians had no capability whatever to launch a surprise attack. And I learned that in 1961. That was a delusion. But my colleague, Herman Kahn, the model for Dr. Strangelove, who invented the term doomsday machine, is a conceptual idea used by Stanley Kubrick in his film, Dr. Strangelove. He felt that the threat was necessary, and to make it credible, you have to prepare to survive it by civil defense, by anti-ballistic missiles and so forth, and actually carry it out if necessary. It has never been possible to be able to survive, really, as a society, even as a population, from nuclear war. That was his delusion. But it reflected the thinking in the Defense Department ever since. When Reagan and Gorbachev agreed, and it's been reiterated now by Putin, even this year, by Putin and Biden, nuclear war cannot be won, and it must not happen. It must not occur. And yet, neither side has ever rejected the idea that nuclear war can be prepared for and rehearsed and threatened and risked. And that's what we're doing. Again, only on the rationale that not that you can do well, not that you won't be devastated even by nuclear war, but that you'll do better if you preempt, if you go first. And that is a cult-like belief, which persists because it's so profitable.
What we're leaving out is the assumption of that debate always was that the other side would be rational, and that, or they would be pretending to be madmen and have more of a threat. But the fact is, first of all, let's be clear, the United States, under the leadership of actually big thinkers at the University of California in Berkeley who were involved with the Los Alamos lab used Fat Man and Little Boy, the first atomic bombs, and killed civilians on a mass level in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, okay, when it was not absolutely necessary, and one could argue not at all necessary. However, they were used. And there's always been a school of thought that says they can be used in some way or another. And then there is irrationality enters, fear enters, being held accountable for other things enters. And what the end of the day, the only thing that defines Russia now as a major power is its possession of nuclear weapons. They have a relatively small population. They have an unsuccessful economy. And we know nationalism produces monstrous possibilities. That's the evil of nationalism, national concern, aggrieved assaults, and so forth. We felt that about Japan, and we dropped those bombs. I don't want to get into that whole discussion. But we're talking about a situation now where, for whatever historic reasons or what have you, there is a Russian leadership that feels besieged. It feels that NATO, which was supposed to be abandoned, has somehow been extended right up to its border. And one card it has to play here is the nuclear weapons card. And there is talk of being able to use that on a limited basis. And I think it seems to me the brunt of your work in the doomsday machine is that accidents can happen, over assessments can happen of survival. I know because I interviewed Ronald Reagan and the first President Bush and others about the possibility of winnable nuclear war. And you mentioned Herman Kahn, but he wasn't alone in thinking there was a use. And so I wonder if you're not underestimating the danger of the moment now.
Well, I don't think I am, because I am frankly very depressed about it. I think that there's really very little that will be done to change that very real danger that you're talking about. There's no prospect of eliminating our ICBMs on either side, no prospect of ending the launch-on-warning policy. It could blow the world up on a mistake, and it's come close to doing so several times. How about eliminating that? It's not going to happen. I think that ship has sailed and into iceberg waters where it is proceeding at full speed on dark nights. So it's very dangerous. Take the climate problem. What's the chance now with the we're actually increasing madly, desperately, the production and emission of fossil fuels right now, oil in particular, and to compensate for Russian sales, which we're trying to avoid. But even beyond that, what's the prospect of, at this point in this world where the world is divided, especially with this crisis now in the last 2 months, into divided into at least two halves that don't negotiate, don't trust each other? What's the chance of the collaboration that's necessary to save civilization from climate catastrophe? I would say on this ship, we've hit the iceberg. I don't see that collaboration happening. That's been a casualty of this war. But to come back to the nuclear problem, the U.S. is acting cautiously to a degree in the face of Putin's nuclear threats. Is it, what would cause him to do that? Could it possibly, would he have to be insane actually to have one nuclear weapon after us to warn us as to where this is going? It could work. Is it likely to work? No, it's likely to blow up. But he could take that chance, just as we have gambled in the past that the other side might back down when we've made our threats. Remember, when you talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that's a different world. We weren't launching those against the nuclear power. We had a monopoly. And as terms of our willingness to kill hundreds of thousands of people, which we did with those two bombs, we killed more than that with firebombs in the preceding 5 months. We killed 100,000 people in one night, burning them alive on the night of March 9th and 10th, 1945, with firebombs over Tokyo. So I think that history of what the U.S. will put up with in the way of killing other people, enemies, has made it possible for us to be threatening nuclear war ever since and preparing for it. But the threats can work. Look, I keep coming back to the fact we're seeing a demonstration in the eyes of the non-nuclear people in the world. We're seeing a demonstration of what Putin can do with his nuclear weapons. He's keeping us out of that war so far. And if it doesn't, if it ceases to work, and we give, he's even threatening a unimaginable increase, I think unpredictable increase, if we give more weapons of the kind we're now giving this week. And further, in effect, he's saying, I could go to nuclear war. Would that be sensible? No, but the threat can work. And if it doesn't, he can believe, as people on our side have argued for a long time, they'll back off. And the likelihood is they won't. So it blows up. And that's why we can't afford, he doesn't feel, as I think you said, Bob, he doesn't feel, as far as we know, that he can afford to lose this war. But we can't afford to defeat it. We can't afford to win it, exactly because that could well press him toward nuclear weapons. He would see it as rational. It's the only way he can keep his job or avoid a great loss or something. And we've been making these threats all along, which are threats of carrying out an insane criminal evil action. Using a nuclear weapon for the first time here and building it up would be insane.
Well, it's not the first time. We keep saying it's the first time.
Bob, it's the first time against a nuclear state. First time when retaliation is possible. The first time when escalation is possible. So when we did it against Hiroshima, it was ruthless, but no more so, actually, than the Tokyo bombing or the 64 other cities we'd hit. There was no retaliation from that. So it wasn't insane in the same sense as it would be to use the same tactics if the Japanese had had a nuclear weapon or if Hitler had had a nuclear weapon. But the Germans, the Russians have had it. And we keep making the threats. I'm saying that remains then as a threat of doing something that would be insane because we would die from it too. And others, every other people in the world would. It's a different order of insanity, if you like. But how about the very preparation of these threats, making them rely, making our alliances rely, as they have ever since NATO was formed, on rely on an assurance we would blow the world up if they were facing a conventional major aggression. That's what we've lived with for over half a century. I would say, from a human point of view, from a species, from the point of view of human civilization, that policy is insane. But it's held by all of our presidents. It is now prepared for entirely by the Russians, to a lesser, much lesser extent, seven other nuclear states, and 30 states in NATO go along with that threat of massive. So it's an insanity that's kind of bred in the bone, as far as I can see it. It's accepted by our civilized leaders, by our educated, intelligent. They don't have to be clinically mad. To get elected and to pursue this policy. And yet, in a longer run sense, I would say it's a fatal, disastrous policy. And I don't see currently any prospect of changing that. I hope I'm wrong. And that's not a slim hope, because I've often been wrong in the past. So I hope that my firm expectations of a prolonged guerrilla war, disastrous to the Ukrainians, as the best outcome there, with negotiation being put off the table, and the possibility of nuclear war, I hope that's wrong, that something comes along that I can't foresee. But I have to say, I don't see it.
Well, it is an optimistic view, but there's always that counter argument, why do we have these weapons? And there's also that illusion that they can be contained. That's what, you know, again, as a journalist, I wanted into.
You have to be kind of a nut, actually, to believe that. And unfortunately, nuts do persist. It would be wrong, I think, Bob, to say that a large number of people in any administration have actually believed that. But acting as if they believed it, our whole policy is based on that.
Let me just conclude this, though. What happened to arms control? I mean, there was an understanding between Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan is the man I talked to, interviewed about the possibility of winning a nuclear war, and he was of the view the Russians might believe that because they were monsters. Well, he changed that view when he met Gorbachev and really seemed to believe, at least temporarily, that we could get rid of these weapons, that they could not be used, and so forth. Well, we haven't made much progress. And in fact, in the recent decades, we have expanded the presence of nuclear weapons. We're not alone in it. Nuclear weapons figure very much in calculations about security, where they're placed, who has control of them. And I'm really quite surprised in this conversation. You seem more sanguine about the role of reason here.
No, I've given a totally wrong impression then, if that's the way you read it, Bob. And no one is more intelligent than you, Bob. So that's a little dismaying if I haven't communicated that. I mean, not the slightest sanguine, because if we differ, it's only on one thing, and I am speaking as an insider, a former insider on this. I get the impression that you think that a lot of people believed what they were saying and acting on at that time. And that's, I do disagree. You don't have to believe this stuff to obey your orders, to go for orders from Northrop Grumman and the others. And they like the orders and they make you a board chairman if you give them the orders. And then you come from Raytheon and then you give orders in the other sense directly. It's been a very profitable and good diplomatically because it's kept us as the supposed protector of Europe all this time. It's a protection racket. There is nothing sanguine I'm saying here because this thing can very well blow up, and we are increasing the chances of it by many aspects of our policy. And I don't see any thing that's going down. I don't believe there's a lot of Curtis LeMays left who did believe, when I was in the Pentagon, I think he did believe that a nuclear war at that time, before they built up more than they did, would be a good thing. That was very rare. I could name a couple other people, mainly acolytes of LeMay, who thought that. The Army didn't think that. The Navy didn't think that, really. And very few people did, but they all went along with it because, take the Navy point of view, as long as they got their submarines, they didn't care if the Air Force got a lot of ICBMs, which the Navy knew perfectly well were only dangerous, not necessary. But they didn't fight them once they got what they wanted. What I'm saying is the humans in power are very dangerous. To say that I'm sanguine, I don't know what you're referring to there. I don't yield to you in pessimism about what the future holds for this species.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Okay, we're gonna wrap this up, but let me just tell you and we've known each other for a long time, and I have obviously great respect for you and your knowledge of all these things. But let me tell you my concern. I see nationalism as the great threat, national arrogance, the notion that, and this is what I see in Russia right now, and why Putin has much more support than many people in this country think. And why, by the way, Gorbachev lost a lot of support, because he basically ended up challenging Russian nationalism and talking about, you know, giving it all up. and Putin's strength, and has nothing to do with communism, has a lot to do with nationalism, is, you know, Crimea is Russia, Ukraine is an invention, Khrushchev gave away everything, you know, Khrushchev the Ukrainian. And I've been witness to that on both sides, all sides. There's Chinese nationalism, there's American nationalism, and so forth. And when then these people, when these disputes come to be defined as the other side are monsters, they're war criminals, which is what is happening right now. The language that has been used to describe Putin's motives and his operation mean negotiations are almost impossible. Nixon did go to China. He did negotiate with Mao Zedong. He had said to her, I'll grant you that. But the fact of the matter is, if we're saying that the people on the other side are going to be treated as Nazi war criminals, and they're going to be tried, and they're going to be, you know, treated in this way, there's very little room for negotiation. And if we say they have no validity whatsoever to their concerns about NATO expansion or anything else, you know, you leave people with very little in the way of an exit strategy. And, you know, and if you cut them off from any kind of economic activity. And this, by the way, applies to our policy towards China increasingly, a total denial of any legitimacy to Chinese concerns or Chinese nationalism. And it seems to me you do have these weapons. And this is, of course, one reason why North Korea wants one, because they think it's the only reason they're still in business. And maybe why Pakistan feels the need for them. Maybe it's why Israel feels the need for it. These are developed as ultimately usable weapons. And this goes beyond the game playing of major powers. It's just a reality that in moments of desperation, these are things that can be used. And we showed that. Even when we weren't desperate, we were willing to use them. We were using to use a weapon that we should have never thought about using.
Bob, and do you really think that I disagree with anything you said here? Because I don't. So I could have said virtually sincerely and fully everything you just said. In fact, I believe I did on a number of points, such as the danger of defining Russia now and China as some kind of monsters unlike us who can't be negotiated with. Unfortunately, in their worst characteristics, they're like us the way they have been. They're not doing anything worse, and that was terribly bad than we did in Iraq, as you know, in Vietnam and the others. But to emphasize that right now and to block negotiations is desperately wrong. If we disagree just on one thing is all I hear. The credibility of using nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear state like Japan or Iran now, Japan in 45, or Iran now, is a very different issue from establishing credibility against the Russians or the Chinese or between India and Pakistan right now, nuclear weapons state. But if you hear that as me being sanguine, then I haven't communicated, because unfortunately, it doesn't have to be totally credible that you'll initiate that war. And it unfortunately, humanly, corporately, institutionally, it is credible enough. We are crazy enough. One way of establishing that credibility is by spending trillions of dollars to enable yourself, is it the U.S. or Russia, to use nuclear weapons or even, you know, launch them, and even India and Pakistan. When you spend that much of national resources on something that can only be suicidal if used, you can't be confident that it won't be used. And that's, as you say, why they do get them. It does give them some deterrence, but that's at the cost of signing on to a world and not opposing it, that really offers a risk of killing not only your adversary and not only yourself, but everybody. And that's true for all these. So there's a madness in not just the nine nuclear states, but in the 30 states that rely on a so-called umbrella. Do they really want it used? Does Poland, let's say, did Germany before really want it used, as they said, if they were attacked by the Soviets? Maybe they did, but that was crazy because they would be annihilated. Did they really fully understand that? I've never known. Did they understand what they were asking for? Let's go right to the president. Isn't Zelensky sincere when he asked for us to attack with our air power, Russian ground-based anti-aircraft, in other words, to clear the skies and to allow our planes to come in there and dominate the situation? It's understandable for him to ask. He's no crazier than so many other people have been in the past. And yet, he is a heroic figure. I have no question about that. But in his desperation, he is asking for something that, if we carried it out, would actually lead to the destruction of his own country. And it might work. And he's willing, in his desperate situation, to truly desperate in an existential way, to take that chance. It might, the others might back off. We don't have that excuse. And yet we are making those threats. In Taiwan, the situation is different. There, we can't carry out our defense that we talk about, our commitment, rock solid commitment to the integrity and sovereignty, which is not official, but the independence of Taiwan. We can't do that without being prepared, and really very prepared, to initiate nuclear war, which would be catastrophic for Taiwan and others. For us to encourage Taiwan to declare official independence and get recognized is, it's, I would say, as not just misguided, but criminally irresponsible policy as our long-term policy of trying to get Ukraine on the border of Russia into NATO. That was incredibly irresponsible, and it has led to where we are right now, which is a catastrophic situation and can get much worse. Same would be true in Taiwan. We've got to stop at this point. We have time to stop. They haven't yet been attacked, doing what every Chinese leader since Mao has said would lead to their invasion of Taiwan, and that is recognizing Taiwan as an independent state. Pelosi is about to go to Taiwan, as far as I know, the first visit by a Speaker of the House, a high-level visit that looks very much like recognizing them as an independent state. I doubt if she's made a visit to any other province of China on the mainland. Biden is getting people over here, officials over here. Trump was the first president to take a phone call from the president of Taiwan. Which other province of China, which is what China sees Taiwan as being, did he take a phone call from? Very like looking at them as independent. That's virtually asking for an invasion of Taiwan, not because it would be sensible and from our longer-term, rational or necessary. These instincts of nationalism and of what who is in your country and who isn't, whether they're however well-based those are characteristics of highly organized humans over the last several millennia of empire that have caused in the past, you know, innumerable casualties. In the nuclear age and the age that requires a global cooperation on climate, those are not just lethal to large numbers of people, they're lethal to human civilization. And that's new. And we're not a species to be trusted with nuclear weapons, but we have them. And I am very sensitive being called sanguine about that situation, because I would say that my life, even back when I was in the Pentagon, was devoted to trying to avoid a nuclear war by means that were wrong. I was mistaken. All I was with were mistaken. It was a terrible delusion that that was the way to avoid nuclear war, by building up our nuclear capability. But it's been a long time since I believed in that. And, you know, I've spent the rest of my life trying to avert what we're risking right now, and without success, I would say. You asked about arms control. The arms control has resulted in a great reduction of numbers of warheads. Meaningless. That has not reduced the risk of nuclear war by an iota, not at all. With the vulnerable ICBMs on both sides, on launch and warning, the risk of nuclear war by mistaken calculation, by wrongful nationalistic cult-like obsessions, by a false belief that first strike remains or is preferable to second strike, very profitable delusions, it's likely to blow up. And at 91, that is not a sense of success in my life or in what you call arms control. Hasn't happened.
We've gone on long, but I'm going to push just one last idea here. And on the you're absolutely right. You know, it'd be difficult to believe you think you or your culture could survive an all-out nuclear war, obviously. The reason I keep bringing up Hiroshima and Nagasaki was the idea that you can use these weapons somehow in a limited way to remind people that you have them. And this is what Putin has been talking about for a long time now, because he kept saying, you know, as he did in, I thought, a very good series that Oliver Stone did interviewing him, he talked about what happened to arms control, what happened to the promise between Reagan and Gorbachev not to rely on these weapons, what happened to the idea of restraint, why have you been pushing us this far, why NATO expansion? And going along with that, you know, people then say, well, what do we have? We have the threat of nuclear weapons, but they don't take it seriously. The next step is what? A demonstration. Maybe you have one explode in the ocean, or maybe you use them in some kind of tactical way. Maybe you get their attention that way. And this whole notion of modernization of these weapons, still having them, is because they, and this is why other nations like Pakistan or Israel, right, want to have them, is that there is a use for them. And when it's the only card that you have to play, if that turns out to be the case, and you are Russia and you are overwhelmed and your army is depleted and they've pushed you against the wall and they've said anyone who backed you or was with you is going to be considered a war criminal, you know, and we're going to have Nuremberg trials for you, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you got these weapons and a lot of money and effort was spent on them. Do you not try a demonstration effect? Do you not use them? That's the scenario that caused me to want to interview you today. And I'm really basing it on having reread your book, and I recommend it to people, The Doomsday Machine, because that's the danger of it. And there's a giddiness now about this, that somehow, oh, it's all about just the Ukraine, or it's all about human rights. No, it isn't. It's about great power struggles. It's about realignment in the world. It's about fear of China's economic power and success and its hookup with Russia. There's a lot at play. And in that environment, if you think you're on the wrong end of finally, and you're not going to just take a pill and kill yourself, you know, you might try one other gambit, which is to show, wait a minute, you better back off because we can do this. And we did it. Hopefully you just killed a lot of fish in the ocean with that kind of thing, which is what the Berkeley scientists recommended for Fat Man and Little Boy. And you don't kill hundreds of thousands of people as we did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's my concern in the current situation.
Well, Bob, I know we've gone over your time limit here and you don't have to use this. But let me, can I just answer that or comment on that?
Absolutely.
For your later, let's just go ahead since we're on here. Okay. First of all, I just, as I keep saying, do not have less concern than you. I'm very concerned. In fact, as I've said to you, depressed about the prospects for nuclear war and the prospects for proliferation, the prospects for collaboration, et cetera, et cetera. I'm very pessimistic, fatalistic almost, except that I know that when I've been certain before that things were going to go wrong, they don't always do it, or right. Okay, let me come back. Here's where my own perspective, I've had to adjust to some extent here from earlier on. I never believed we would get through the last 70 years without a nuclear war. I thought that was so unlikely as of 1959 when I joined RAND. that I didn't join their insurance campaign, the TIAA CREF, a very generous retirement plan. So I have no retirement money because I didn't think there was any chance I would live to cash in on it. Nuclear war could be postponed, and that's what I was trying to do, but not that long. Now, how come it has been that long? And as I say, a first reason was the Russians really weren't racing with us at that time. But later they were, and for a long time they have. I would not have predicted that either U.S. or the Soviet Union would allow themselves to lose war without actually firing a nuclear weapon, of which they had many. And I wasn't alone in this. I think many, many people thought, that's just not going to happen. That's why the war is almost certain. Actually, we allowed, both sides allowed a stalemate to occur in Korea without launching their nuclear weapons, although we did use them by threatening them. And for that matter, the Soviet Union was using them by threatening them. Neither side, of course, they only had a very few at that time. We had plenty. We didn't actually use them, even though Eisenhower was quite open to doing it, and he did threaten them. Okay, then you go to Vietnam. I think that if China had not had nuclear weapons as of 1964, we would have launched nuclear weapons in Vietnam before allowing ourselves to lose it, as we did. But the possibility of Chinese reaction was a key factor there in are not actually doing things for which we actually had plans for, all written out. Dien Bien Phu earlier, Khe San, and then 1969, 1972, but they weren't actually carried out. What I'm saying is, then we have the Soviets in Afghanistan. We had neutron bombs then, as we do now. You think they couldn't have used those with any effect? But they didn't. They lost the war. We lost the war in Afghanistan without using them. Now, what is one to draw from this? One would be, but I think it's mistaken, they'll never get used. People are so cautious, it turns out that they'll never use them. I think, in effect, you're accusing, asserting that I think that. I don't think that at all. But I do see that, you know, they're a little more cautious than I expected them to be. Does that mean they won't get used? No. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, I concluded by participating in it, and then more than 40 years of studying it ever since. I think I know that thing. I have a different understanding than almost anybody else, right or wrong. And my understanding is that neither Khrushchev nor Kennedy believed they could win a nuclear war. Neither of them believed that they could contain a conventional war. So both of them, in threatening war, were bluffing, in my opinion. They were determined not to go to any armed conflict, like today in Ukraine. And yet, they were determined to make threats in such a way that the world came within a hair's breadth of blowing up, despite the fact that they were not, LeMay was not in charge. Yes, he did perhaps send a U-2 over to the Soviet Union at one point, or he may not, Kennedy thought he had. But it didn't cause a war because both sides did not want a war. And yet, they almost caused the nuclear war, just unless Arkhipov on the submarine B-59 on the Soviet side had not vetoed launching a nuclear torpedo, you and I wouldn't be here. It would have ended. And then later in 1983, Petrov looked at Reagan. Reagan wasn't about to have a first strike, but Andropov thought he was the leader. And so he prepared an intelligence system to tell him, when is the hour? When will this happen? Watch, it was the biggest intelligence operation probably in history, so that he could preempt. To what effect? What if we were about to attack? Just like us, he would have wanted to get the first strike in. And fortunately, that didn't happen for various reasons, one of which being that Sergei Petrov, Stanislav Petrov in Russia, chose not to report what may have been an incoming U.S. attack, which it wasn't, but he wasn't sure that it wasn't. And without that, again, you and I wouldn't be here. So what I'm saying, you know, on the one hand, the key thing is I do believe it's more than possible in some circumstances for the thing to blow up. As you say, even more possible than a limited regional attack will occur and maybe blow up or not, because of this belief that maybe they'll back off. How stupid is that? How reckless is that? Can people, however, believe it? This escalate to de-escalate? That's our NATO policy. What they keep talking about is a Russian idea of a demonstration weapon was our NATO policy for Berlin for many years. And very highly educated and experienced people said, well, that's what we'll have to do. It would be crazy to do it. Might they have done it? Yes. However crazy in the desperate situation. So what I'm saying is now it doesn't require people to be actually giddy about actually believing this stuff. I do believe that the war is very dangerous. And by the way, what should we do if, as you say, if Putin does, in fact, what we're warning about, use a nuclear weapon? Should we respond to it? Actually, not. That could only increase the chance of an overall escalation. Would we? Maybe yes, maybe not. Probably yes, I think. So the risks would be taken. And if they weren't, one way or another, the experience of the last 70 years, Bob, does tell me that both sides might back off from escalating totally. They might. That's a real possibility. They are worried about it. It's far from a certainty. It's at best like 50-50 or less. But supposing they don't blow the world up, then what happens? Mass proliferation. Everybody sees, the precedent has been broken. Now we should have our nuclear weapons so we can deter others, so we can do what Putin just did and got away with it, if he did get away with it. If he didn't get away with it, then nobody would have decisions to make. But if somehow it does get limited, then people can say, okay, we need these things to make our own threats. And we may have an era of limited nuclear wars before the U.S. and Russia blow the whole thing up. Maybe that's not a wonderful future either. So that's what we're facing. I think for the last time, I'll say you don't have to be as crazy as LeMay to make this world a very dangerous place. Every president we have had has made it a dangerous place. And Putin now has clearly joined them.
Okay. On that note, let's scratch a little bit of optimism from it. I want to thank you, Dan Ellsberg, a lifetime of calling our attention to things that we didn't know about and needed to. There it is. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW and thank the station for posting these programs, the great staff there. Joshua Shearer, our executive producer, Natasha Kimi Zapata for writing the introductions, Lucy Berbio for the transcriptions. I want to thank the JKW Foundation, memory of Gene Stein, a terrific writer, for helping support the show, and TM Scruggs for providing really decisive support. Thank you. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.